So, let's see.
Well, thank you very much for a very graceful introduction. And I have to thank you, Avi, for impelling me down the road of Ibn Arabi studies in this building 35 years ago when we were transliterating the prayers of Ibn Arabi. And I also want to thank Peter Young and all the staff here for the invitation and for hosting me. And of course, I want to thank all of you for turning up. Of course, the students on the course have had to turn up, but the rest of you have chosen to. And I also want to say a big thank you, really, to all past and present in Bishara, because without the Bishara school and its instigator, Bulent Rauf, I don't think that would be a single person here, sitting here, because this house would be still probably derelict. The title of my talk is rather a big subject, human being human. And I also suffer from a conundrum, which as you see will be one of the threads in the talk. The conundrum has been how on earth to talk about this subject within an hour. The first time I gave this talk was in London, and I ended up talking for over an hour and a half. The second time was last night in Edinburgh, and I had assiduously worked to try and cut it down, and it ended up at an hour and a half. So all I can tell you is that I'm not going to give you the Spielberg version today. It will be definitely reduced. But it is a topic about which one could go on and on and on for months, years, probably the rest of our lives. So you'll have to forgive me if I run over time. So the conundrum is, how do I resolve the fitting of it into the time available and actually say something worthwhile? That could be one of the subtitles of this talk, how to resolve conundrums or not, as the case may be. First conundrum, then, that I want to start with is contained in the words human being. When we talk of a human being, do we think of it as a noun or a verb? Is a human being a something? Therefore a noun, or is it actually a human being in a process or state of being, and therefore a verb? And if a human being is a something, what kind of something is it? Is it a concrete noun, something solid, or is it something in the mind, an abstract concept only? Or is it both? Now, of course, we can treat the body as a solid, concrete object, but the more closely we look, the more we find a mass of processes, neurons firing, cells working constantly, and so on. An organism which is flowing with life and awareness. So there's really nothing solid or fixed about any of it. Or perhaps solidity is just one possible description. And anyway, does this body and head and trunk and arms and legs, is this what we mean by a human being, or is there some sort of extra consciousness factor X which we have to take into the equation? Or on the other side, is a human being a mental construct which we derive from our perceptions of self and others? On the other hand, if a human being is a verb, is this being human something dynamic? Is it something we do, an action or an activity? Or is it a state of being, a state of becoming? Or even worse, is it both, or all of these things, or none of them? So you can see the conundrums just multiply as soon as you start to look at anything. The fact that we can pose questions like this reflects not simply something about the language that we have, but also the way our minds are actually built. A two-sided creature with a brain divided into right and left hemispheres. And these hemispheres operate quite differently and yet cooperate. And as modern neuroscience is discovering, we have remarkable abilities because we have two hemispheres. And I'm going to refer to some of these neuroscientific findings as we go along. The question about being human also reflects something about the English language, where we can play with human being. After all, we don't think of cat being or mouse being. It is human being. It's curious. This is not the only language that such oddities have happened in. So in Arabic, all nouns are really a network of verbs or formulations based on verbs. And these verbs are actually just three letters or four letters put together. One of the words for human being, as all of you here are aware, is the word insan. Now, first of all, there are several words in Arabic for the word human being in English, and insan is only one of them. As you've come across in your studies, al-insan al-kamil, the complete or perfect man. But it's a very strange word because it's actually a kind of dual. This particular form of the language where you can actually have a word which says two things, which we can't do in English. We have either a singular or a plural. And in Arabic, there is this sort of middle ground for two. There is a lot of discussion among Arabists as to what is the nature of this two-ness that is in the formation of the human being. So for Ibn Arabi, for example, the root of the word insan can be understood two ways, either as derived from nasi, nisyan, which means forgetfulness, or from the root anisa, uns, familiarity. And familiarity here has connotations of sociability, friendliness, being amicable, and taking joy in the company of others. So for him, the term human being, insan, denotes at the same time forgetfulness of our nature and familiarity with it. And it seems that this ambiguity is very much part and parcel of being human. We can't escape it, even if we wanted to. And it's in the process of examining such polarities that we can discover something about the nature of the self, the nature of our own selves. But of course, everybody here is discovering what it is to be human. Every story here is unique and powerful. In a recent television program, there was a thing called The History of the World by Andrew Marr, which was actually really not a history of the world at all, it was a history of mankind. And he summarized our modern predicament in the last program by saying, in the midst of all this crisis that we're all facing, we are a clever ape in a spot of bother. This is a very popular, witty, self-deprecating way of talking about human beings. It's also a kind of surreptitious siding with animals because it connects us to other creatures. So a clever ape, nothing more. We're just top of the evolutionary tree. Yes, we may be more intelligent than all the rest, but actually we're just really an ape. No doubt a reaction to the long-held belief that there was something special about the human being, something that divided us from all other creatures, namely that we are built in the divine image, which is not something one can go around talking about too much anymore without immediately being labeled. So we are just an ape these days. Yes, a clever one. And to be clever means we're able to rise above all the difficulties that we face if we use our intelligence well, which of course, if you look at history, as I was trained to do, is a slightly difficult matter because history is littered with casualties. Let's say we look at our DNA. We're closer to chimpanzees than chimps are to gorillas. And of course, in quantifiable percentage terms, our DNA is said to hardly differ from that of a mouse. Well, we're very impressed with such figures because we've all been taught to like numbers and we think they're very important factors. Even if when we look at ourselves, we certainly don't want to see ourselves as a percentage or a number. We can't look for what is particular or unique about human beings in terms of DNA, because that would be like trying to understand the characteristics of 11 by adding 1 to 10. So adding 1 to 10, it enables you to reach the number 11, but it tells you nothing about the properties of 11. So how are we to accommodate being human? This machine is now going to go to sleep on me like it did yesterday. Yep. It's very curious when we meet another human being. What do we focus on? How aware are we of our common humanity first, that the other is just like us? Same dreams, same fears, same aspirations, same consciousness, same ignorance. It's about the most obvious aspect of another human being, and yet how readily we ignore it. We are very keen in our minds to focus on difference. That could be ethnicity, it could be gender. Even though if we look at human populations and we look at the from a genetic point of view, there is this much difference between Asian, European, African. We are 99.999% identical. So what is this inability to see this common humanity which is staring us in the face? Is it a reflection of the fact that we do not see full humanity in our own self? I have no doubt that this is why in the Middle East people are taught to greet each other with salam or shalom, peace. At least let your tongue say it, even if the rest of you doesn't know how to affirm it. Awareness of our fellow human beings is very often narrowed down to the simple fact we share the same physical space. So we become neighbours, we become collaborators, and of course the discourse, as Colin Tudge was talking about recently, the discourse of being competitors for resources. You perhaps know well the story of a man who went to hell and went and found a huge banqueting table laid out with wonderful food, and people sitting there on either side, they had huge spoons this long, and they were trying to get the food into their mouths and were totally frustrated at being unable to. And then he was taken to heaven, exactly the same table laid out, exactly the same people sitting around in the chairs with the big spoons, and this time they were feeding people on the other side of the table. Same ingredients, totally different outcomes. So, yes, we are in a spot of bother. We have 7 billion human beings alive on the planet, which is a 350% increase in my lifetime alone. But I think, I hope that all of you have come to the conclusion that what is going on out there in the world, this ecological crisis, is actually a reflection of a crisis at a much deeper level. So we could characterize it perhaps as a battle between a narrow, childish self-centeredness and a broad humanity, truth-centered, where people are imbued with respect and compassion for themselves and for others, and capable of living in harmony with all creatures. So we range on a scale somewhere between these two all the time. And the preponderance of our life is really determined by how we figure in it. After all, there's little point in being angry about somebody else being self-centered, like our partner or the boss at work, people in the local community, or even worse still, people on the other side of the planet who are clearly doing terrible things. There's little point in being angry about that if we're unable and unwilling to look at our own self-centeredness and deal with our own anger and negotiate, I emphasize this word, negotiate a way out of it. So we may appear to be a human being, but being human is a rather different challenge. Of course, being fully human is what all religions have stressed. So what Taoists see in the superior man of the I Ching, what Buddhists see in the awakened selflessness of the Buddha, what Christians see in the light of Jesus and Muslims in the perfection of Muhammad, is this capacity of the true human being, where inner conflicts and splits have been resolved. It's a lot easier to appreciate what this means if you come into contact with somebody who embodies this wisdom, compassion, and dignity. And I well remember when I first started reading wonderful stories of extraordinary Sufi women and men, and I came across a man, and I was talking to him about it, and suddenly the conversation turned, and he said, and almost before he said it, I felt I was in the presence of a biblical patriarch, "I have been walking and talking with God for over 40 years. And I knew precisely that he meant it." For Karen Armstrong, religion, she says, the point of religion is to live intensely and richly here and now. Religious people are ambitious. They want lives overflowing with significance. They have always desired to integrate with their daily lives the moments of insight and rapture that came to them in dreams, in their contemplation of nature, in their intercourse with one another and with the animal world. Well, we all want lives overflowing with significance, don't we? I mean, that goes without saying. Or do we? Because I can only speak for myself, I am aware of how often and how clearly I don't integrate moments of insight. Now, this ambition, which I take for granted that we share, rests on two very, very important factors, which I want to stress today. The first is to have established a real fundamental sense of self-worth and dignity. My own value and dignity as a human being. Now, I emphasize it, and somebody commented on this last night, I emphasize it because so many people suffer from low self-respect. Now, this to me is precisely what used to be called being created in the divine likeness, in the divine image. That is where this self-worth lies. The second part of it is equally important, to have a very clear sense of transcendence, that there is always more than what we can encompass in our knowledge and experience. So at the same time as fully appreciating what's present to us, we're aware that there's always increase. And then we can recognize that what is coming to us from our own reality, which is both in this moment and beyond it. For an analogy, think of a film. If you are watching a film, you're perfectly aware that the scene you're looking at is not the whole film. You can only watch the whole film by going through the scenes. And there's no point in trying to cheat by thinking you can watch the whole film by getting the DVD case out and reading the blurb on the back. Of course, at a deeper level, the film, which I mean life, the film, all its plot, actors, scenes, and everything else, is nothing but the viewer. It's nothing but us. It's the contents of us, if we know how to look at it. We can't avoid seeking increase. It's part of the very nature of being human. We yearn for greater significance and fulfillment in our lives, even if we often hold ourselves back from it by believing it's not really possible for me. But surely a life that's devoid of meaning, or one where the meaning is consistently diminished, it must be the greatest torture and affliction that a human being can possibly endure. It's far worse than being in a war zone, far worse than being in prison. A life overflowing with significance, well, that demands a courageous, loving openness to not knowing, to really allowing what is unknown to reveal itself to us. Actually, that's what's happening, but the problem is we interfere. That's surely worth striving for. But here are the words of one of Ibn Arabi's later followers, 13th century Persian mystical poet who came to Konya and studied with Sadruddin Konevi. His name is Fakhruddin Iraki. And he once wrote a quatrain like this: seeking life without the friend's presence, you didn't spend a moment at love's door. My God, sit down and mourn your loss. That time is gone when you could have been living. So I've talked enough about urgency of this is right smack between the eyes. I want to present you with two models of perfectibility, which on first sight come from very different traditions, one from the Christian tradition, one from the Islamic tradition. And I want to put them together, juxtapose them, to show how they're representations of the same meaning. So the first is a very familiar picture for some of you, I'm sure. One of the really the most profound and beautiful images in the Christian world, that of the Annunciation, the meeting of Gabriel in human form with the human Mary. This is the fresco in a corridor of the San Marco convent in Florence by Fra Angelico. And if you haven't seen it in the flesh, I thoroughly recommend you go as quickly as you can. It is a stupendous wonder. The art historian Ernst Gombrich wrote, "The true miracle of the language of art is not that it enables the artist to create the illusion of reality. It is that under the hands of a great master, the image becomes translucent." In other words, it doesn't really matter what happened historically. What matters is how revealing this picture is of meaning, which is all that the physical historical event is anyway. Gregory of Nyssa, one of the great fathers of Orthodox Christianity. It is from contemplation of the word that we really understand the meaning of the historical event. because the historical event is constantly occurring. So that's really how I want to look at this picture today. This translucence, however, will only come if we can overcome a very obsessive tendency towards idolatry, by which I mean fixing the meaning in one image. So Henri Corbin, who wrote a wonderful book about Ibn Arabi, once wrote about idolatry, it means immobilizing yourself before an idol because you see it as opaque, because you're incapable of discerning in it the hidden invitation that it offers to go beyond it. Hence, the opposite of idolatry would not consist in breaking idols, in practicing a fierce iconoclasm against every inner or external image. It would rather consist in rendering the idol transparent to the light invested in it. In short, it means transmuting the idol into an icon. This is a really important passage, because idols are usually taken to mean physical objects. But any attempt to put meaning into one image is idolatry. And what we have to do, or what we can do, is unleash the meaning that is there by recognizing that and simultaneously allowing it to be an icon for us. I've chosen this image, this Marian image, particularly because it's a visual representation of meaning. And that is somehow more universal and direct. It's not in words, it's not in language, it's in image, but we still have to read it, we still have to decode it. And we have to remember that it was viewed very differently by a medieval audience. So we have to abandon some of our more cherished modern conceptions, such as perspective, for example. So let us look in more detail at the picture. Mary is in seclusion when confronted with Gabriel. And interestingly, the artist shows the retreat cell as closed to the ordinary world entirely. The small window at the back goes onto the dark world beyond. And that dark world I'll talk about in a minute. The other part of the picture is completely open. There's no closure at all. It's as if saying she's totally open to the spiritual world. And as you know, in the biblical account in St. Luke, she's initially described as troubled, diatarasso in Greek. It's a word that often is used to describe the reaction to an angel. So if an angel comes, this is what happens to us. The first reaction is troubled in the sense of perplexed. Well, it's very unsurprising because Gabriel is here in human form, and that's the form of the world that she is in retreat from. In the Quranic story, of course, she's depicted as rejecting the apparent other. She is seeking refuge in the All-Compassionate, in the Rahman. And as you know, Ibn Arabi comments that she went into a state of complete spiritual presence with God. She rejected otherness completely at this moment. And that if, and this is one of the great insights, if the breath of Gabriel had been blown in at that moment, Jesus would have come out totally unbearable. He would have been totally rejective of otherness. So what changes the dynamic, and this is the really important thing, is the reassurance from Gabriel of the glad tidings. When she's reassured, then she can accept with gladness. I want to say at this point something about this reassurance, these glad tidings, which, as you're all aware, the word Bashara comes from. I want to say a little bit about the word Bashara, partly because I had a question mark in my mind when I was writing this paper. Why is there a word for human being, Bashar, related to this annunciation, this glad tidings, Bashara? So in the lexicon, the Arabic lexicon, the word bishara or Arabic bushra is, and I quote, "the annunciation that produces a change in the complexion, the bashara, of a person." It's a bit like if you tell somebody you've just become a parent, you have a baby. Something happens on the face immediately. Normally, of course, this is a joyful annunciation. It could also be used for an announcement of bad news. The most distinctive feature of Bashara is the change in the way the person, the Bashar, another word for human being, the way this person looks due to a very strong emotion. So emotion is fundamental. You know, it doesn't matter whether the color wells up in the cheeks, shining, joyful, or whether it drains out in fear. Both are the same idea. This is what the bashar is, the human being who shows all these different states. Of course, when Mary accepts the good news, the bashara, her state changes dramatically to one of good news, which is the very nature of Jesus. Now look in this picture how the two figures are leaning towards each other in joyful greeting. Notice too something about the light, which is something that a medieval audience would have picked up immediately. The light on the figure of Mary is right coming over her face, and there is a shadow which you can see under her stool. On the other hand, Gabriel is, the light is not from behind him, as you might expect, looking at her, and he doesn't cast a shadow. There's a very important difference being depicted between the Marian human and the Gabrielian superhuman figure. But as Ibn Arabi has commented on this, and I think it's really important to stress, it is the state of Mary that is crucial to the way that Jesus appears. Or to put it in very general terms, because you think I'm talking about a picture, the state of our receptivity is what determines the outcome of a situation. So the state of our receptivity actually determines our living. Rumi comments, for example, that this taking refuge from the form of Gabriel is like trying to retreat from your own self. The image of the angel is actually the very form of your own inner being. So one way of reading this picture is to see Mary as the body of knowledge, the body of the known, the relative self, and Gabriel as the body of the unknown, the appearance of the total self. And of course, we can ask ourselves, you know, when an invitation comes to us out of the blue, in inverted commas, what is our response? What does it meet with? If a friend, for example, invites you to visit, and you're tired, you're overburdened with work, there's a conflict perhaps between wanting to go and visit and being, no, I think I need to sleep or I need to eat or whatever. How do we reach a resolution of that internal conflict? I'm giving you a very simple example, but this is basically how we navigate our way through living. How do we know what's best? How do we know where the invitation came from? How many invitations have we already accepted and it didn't go quite how we imagined, and really I'm not sure I want to go through all that again? Are we at the mercy of unconscious buried patterns which govern our behavior and we're not even aware of them? Oh, I never accept invitations, you know, it was too dangerous. And when it's not a conscious thought, it's a visceral reaction. Most importantly, do we accept the angel's invitation in our own experience? Of course, with Mary, she's portraying the contemplative dynamic of coming to a true understanding of seeing the form conveying meaning about one's own reality. There's one other thing about this painting I want to point out. The radical gap between the place of Gabriel and the place of Mary. The symbolism of the pillar in the middle is very important, and it appears in other parts of Fra Angelico's paintings. So Gabriel really is not of this world. He comes from the dark forest beyond, and yet he's capable of having effect on this Marian consciousness. In some sense, then, the unknown never enters the known at all. It doesn't become known. There's a radical difference, and that's what I was referring to earlier on by the sense of transcendence. But the animating breath that appears, that crosses the divide, that is there if we have the necessary receptivity. I want to remind ourselves that this is a representation. The image in the fresco is kind of cinematic, Hollywood, tender, loving image. There are other ways of describing this event, equally valid, because the Annunciation in reality is the total event, all the actors, the announcement, and all the consequences. As you've read, Ibn Arabi says, Jesus is the symbol of the divine creative act, not just the powers of resurrection, not just the giving of life to the dead as in the story of Lazarus. Much, much further, his whole conception, his whole birth, are iconic metaphors for the divine act of cosmic creation. Just as the new human erupts into the world, so does the whole universe itself erupt from the invisible through the process we, of course, refer to as the Big Bang. If you want a personal hold on this, because those might seem like huge things, the flash of inspiration that appears from the unseen. So from a spiritual perspective, the Annunciation is actually representing what takes place before the Big Bang. In metaphysics, it is the relating of one to itself, an action of envisaging all the multiple possible contents of the self in order to give birth to its own self. I'm referring, of course, to I Was a Hidden Treasure, which incidentally, in Ibn Arabi's terminology, is always quoted not as I was a hidden treasure, but I was an unknown treasure, and I loved to be known. The I Was a Hidden Treasure is a kind of Eastern Rumi version of the same saying. This idea of the Annunciation enclosing and encapsulating all of its contents is, I think, why Bulent Rauf, founder of the Bishara school, once likened Bishara to an explosion, where the cause of the explosion, myriad effects, mutual space and time are all included. He said, the glad tidings means, and I quote, not only the act of blowing, the breath of Gabriel, nor only the act of reception, nor only the gestation of Jesus in Mary, nor the announcement alone is Bishara. Bishara is the whole episode inclusive of all that happened with the coming of Christ. He went on to say that it meant through people, each attaining their own goal, it means the universal esoteric platform for the coming of Christ for the second time, i.e. the second Bishara. So, going back to the picture, we can interpret it as speaking really to every person about the possibility of being truly human. Mary here, the self or the soul, in perfect receptivity and openness to the divine, in a state of expansion resulting from the good news, the good news being precisely the imminent arrival of Jesus, a living spiritual intelligence embodying a new unified vision that sees all things as they really are. It is, in effect, the fulfillment of the ordinary superficial human, the Bashar, resulting in the appearance of the divinely human insan. This Christian model is, of course, visual. It's an event of creation. There are other ways we can portray it, which I'll go on to in just a minute. In the language of Sufism, a predecessor of Ibn Arabi, Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, described the whole business of being human as a two-part process. Here I mean the process of becoming a real human being. He said the first part, and I quote, is the total purification of the heart from everything other than God. The end is being completely lost in God. End of quote. So he's emphasizing that what looks like a journey from the A of our lack of awareness, our impurity and imperfection, to the Z of our purification and perfection, all of it, up to the complete drowning in God, he says, is like the entrance hall in relation to the whole house. So long as there is any sense of a conflictive duality in the self, the real meaning of unity cannot be known. So that brings me to the AAA part of my talk, which is awareness, ascension, and attainment. But now that Britain has been downgraded, I'm not quite sure whether I should go into all three. How are we doing for time? So, awareness, I will do very briefly because I know here you spend quite a lot of time talking about it in one way or another. And hopefully practicing it. fully appreciating what is present to us at each moment. That is what I would designate as awareness. Well, it's, as you all know, great, powerful challenge. The first item in Ibn Arabi's list of technical terminology for a student is the moment, the waqt, which he defines as how you are during the present state without looking at the past or the future. There are so many ways of being able to describe all this, but this is an absolutely fundamental, basic principle. If you're not here, you're not here. Sometimes it's talked about in terms of divine names, these descriptors for the qualities which are perceived and discerned in the divine presence of the moment. So, for example, becoming a place of manifestation for the name forgiver. It's often people think, oh, it means being able to forgive others. Well, its also primary meaning would be to be able to forgive yourself rather than exact punishment on yourself for what one would deem my bad behavior. That implies a very deep awareness and understanding of the way in which we actually do punish ourselves. So for awareness, I want to put the emphasis on being aware of deficiencies. And if you think that's odd, then let me quote to you a passage from Rumi. How can alchemy be seen if copper's low-grade inferior nature is not known? Deficiencies are mirrors of perfection. The vilest things are mirrors of his glory. Whoever understands his own defects has galloped to perfection with 10 horses. So let me move to the kind of second model of perfectibility in terms of the ascension. Let me find a few pictures. I'm going to jump some of the slides, give you an idea of. The basis of the ascension story, as you well know, is the Prophet Muhammad's night journey through the heavens, a narrative story this time of journeying and return. And the journey is described in terms of the whole cosmological universe of medieval thought. Seven heavens, lote tree, lunar mansions, sky of fixed stars, gardens of paradise, divine footstool, divine throne, and more. And as you're aware, this is a journey not so much to the divine presence, since that is everywhere, but a journey, as Ibn Arabi describes it, to see some of the divine signs which otherwise remain hidden. By divine sign, I think we can say that what is meant is a form that reveals meaning, a translucent image. Yes, the whole medieval conception like this has been cast aside by modern scientific rationalism, but I really do think, and I want to emphasize today, it is very important to spend some time with this as a cosmological myth, a psychological reality, a universe that is fundamentally imaginal, by which I mean of the imagination in the true sense, not physical. I'm not going to go into a description today of seven celestial spheres, far too long, I don't have time. I want to concentrate on two aspects of the night journey, which I think are relevant to transformation and perfectibility. The first is the sphere. The medievals conceived of the universe as spherical, not like Einstein in terms of physical space, but in terms of psychological space, that the space of consciousness is really circular or spherical. That is an insight which goes back at least to Plato, and probably much earlier. For the early Greeks, as for the Arabs, the sphere was the shape of perfection, because it is the manifestation of, or the appearance and expansion of, the dot, the point. This is not an idea or a concept, I hasten to add. It is really to do with an observation about the world in which we find ourselves. The French painter Delacroix once wrote about architecture, "Everything is conceptualized by the human being. The straight line is his own creation. It plays no part in nature." Then we have William Blake, on the other hand, who comes up and says, well, there's every line in nature, which of course is true, particularly at the microscopic level in crystals, there are straight lines. But as a general principle, Delacroix is quite right. We live in a curved world, and our buildings are functional straightnesses. In modern neuroscience, we've begun to discover that the right side of the brain is associated with sphericality and roundedness, and the left side is quite different. It's analytical, it's investigative, and it's linear. So whether you're a mystical writer like Ibn Arabi or a new modern neuroscientist, this linearity, which has been very successful in the world, it is, after all, the path of scientific and technological development. But if you take it on its own, in terms of the inner life, it is a complete illusion. It creates an imagined distance between a here and a there, between a birth and a death. Circular motion, on the other hand, changes opposites into complements. As you know, T.S. Eliot wrote, "In my end is my beginning. Wholeness is roundedness." So when we think of the ascension, we have to be very careful how we visualize it. It really means moving away from the world of oppositions into, let us call it, the curved principles of the spiritual world. That's why always in the descriptions, the first level after moving from the Earth is into the sphere of the Moon. This is a very important insight because here it means that all the apparent oppositions are resolved. But then the further insight, and this is really important in the story, is that there are degrees of wholeness. There are different planetary spheres. So leaving the globe of Earth means entering the sphere of the Moon. Leaving the Moon means entering the sphere of Mercury. But with the coming of Muhammad, something changed in this conception. Each planetary sphere or heaven in his ascension and night journey is ruled by a prophetic human figure. In his ascension, Muhammad meets Adam in the heaven of the Moon, Jesus in the Mercury, and so on. So we've moved from Aristotle's universe with, I think, 55 nested spheres. We've moved suddenly to a 28-degree cycle in Ibn Arabi's cosmology, and each level of it is ruled by a human form, a human spiritual reality, which, as you know, is one of the prophets. And the whole of it is the cycle of existence, which is the divine throne itself. And that's not all, because there's more after that. So that's the first point about the ascension. Second point, really important, I want to introduce you to a word which I've discovered is not used by most people at the moment, so I don't know why. Mimesis. When Ibn Arabi writes about this ascension, he writes about it in many different ways, but in one of his books, one of the chapters of Futuhat, which I'm translating at the moment, he speaks about two travelers who go up this ascension. And one of them is basically a kind of ordinary person, you know, intellectual, uses their mind, and he calls him a kind of speculative rationalist kind of type. The other one is, if you looked at the Arabic straight off, you'd probably say, well, it's an imitator. Basically, you know, you do your prayers and do all that. But I think Ibn Arabi is very, very clever, because after a little bit of this journey, suddenly this imitator, in inverted commas, turns into a mystic, a full-fledged mystic. There's no doubt about it. So why has he used this kind of idea of copying, of imitating? Well, in modern neuroscience, they're now beginning to talk about mimesis. And I'll quote a modern neuroscientist. The enormous strength of the human capacity for mimesis is that our brains let us escape from the confines of our own experience and enter directly into the experience of another human being. It comes about through our ability to transform what we perceive into something we directly experience. It is founded on empathy and grounded in the body. End of quote. So this kind of imitation, in inverted commas, this mimesis, involves intention, aspiration, attraction, empathy, but it's what we all know because we've all been babies and children. It's how we learnt things. It's a kind of mythic identification. It's an imaginal, empathic embodiment. Of course, that's why one should be extremely careful with imagination, because we actually participate and become what we imagine. This was quite well known before. You know, Pascal, for example, says the path to virtue is by imitation of the virtuous. And it's what, for me, makes the whole ascension story an extraordinarily powerful symbol of transformation, because on each degree there are human models of spherical wholeness, we could say. And their prophetic function hasn't ceased. So one can say today, where we are living in a world called the space age, where people have gone to the moon, we have collectively and immediately entered the sphere of Adam. Willy-nilly, whether you're aware of it or not, we have entered the sphere of the prototype total human being. They're now talking about going to Mars or something. Yeah. So, in his depiction of these two travellers, the rationalist has a bit of a problem, because everywhere he goes, all he does is meet the planet. So it's a kind of Ibn Arabi novel, actually, in the middle of this chapter. You know, the poor old guy just goes to the planet, and the planet takes him off to a separate room, and it gets really bad when he gets to Saturn, because he gets left in a little room all by himself. And meanwhile, the mystic has a jolly good time and is greeted by the prophet and made welcome and blah, 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 and has a much happier time. So you can see how in Ibn Arabi's depiction, he is beginning to say, if you just follow your intellect, try and work things, everything out like that, and want to know everything, that's where you'll end up. You'll end up in a place where which is completely empty, because all that knowledge will actually be taken away from you when you die. On the other hand, if you go by the other route, you will meet with what brings you your complete happiness, which brings me really to the last bit of my talk. The third A, attainment. Well, I guess it should be obvious from everything I've said that true happiness is not the same thing as the state of feeling happy. There's just been a last year publication of a World Happiness Report, which is founded on the idea of what's going on in Bhutan, where they don't have gross national product, they have gross national happiness, and they measure things in terms of this. This report is actually very interesting and covers a huge amount of research which is going on into what makes us happy and equally what makes us miserable. But when it comes to our inmost experience as a human being, it really isn't numbers that matter. I mean, it frankly doesn't matter where I am on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of happiness. You know, whether I evaluate my life, have I lived a good life, am I happy with my life, or am I happy now? And they ask you to fill in forms which say, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10. And frankly, does it matter how many heavens there are? I mean, all we're ever going to comprehend is the heaven that we can reach, no more. What's important, and I wanted to put the emphasis on this, is how we navigate our way through internal conflict, how we resolve apparent opposites. Because in the resolution of apparent opposites, we reach this immediately, this degree of wholeness which is meant in the ascension. And remember that happiness, to whatever degree, is the fruit of our living. So for Ibn Arabi, for the person of true insight, of Kashf, he writes, it is from the tree of his own soul that he gathers the fruit of his knowledge. Now, I'm perfectly well aware, by the way, that my portrayal of Jesus as exemplifying human divine consciousness in its fullest extent is not at all how the conventional Christian Jesus is depicted. He was embodied. He suffered pain, he shared the suffering of his fellow human beings, he died on the cross. In fact, most of the images of Jesus, especially in the Catholic world, are grotesquely anti-happy. I'm also aware, and I'm going to quote a Polish professor of philosophy whose name I've excluded from the quote, who used to be at Oxford. He writes, happiness is something we can imagine but not experience. If we imagine that hell and purgatory are no longer in operation and all human beings have been saved by God and are enjoying celestial bliss, lacking nothing, then we can imagine that their happiness is real and that the sorrows and suffering of the past have been forgotten. Such a condition can be imagined, but it has never been seen. Well, interesting. It's interesting to compare that with the sayings, for example, of the Buddha. What is happiness? Real inner contentment. For Gandhi, when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony. For Ibn Arabi, the truly happy one is one in whom God is well pleased. And he states, everyone is both pleasing and loved. Everything that the loved one does is loved. In other words, happiness is associated with the attainment of perfection. One of Ibn Arabi's followers, Kashani, writes, the happiness of each thing lies in reaching the completion that exists within itself. So even on a partial level, this is absolutely true. A hungry person, their happiness lies in getting a good meal. Yes, it may be temporary, but that's the nature of that kind of hunger. A lover, their happiness will be in being with the beloved, and so on. For Ibn Arabi, all happiness lies, he said, in knowing God, the very purpose of existence. But that is surely just the beginning of a new kind of life. All that stands in the way of such an outcome is imagining that we're something, not seeing that we are already loved and pleasing. In the words of Adyashanti, because of an innocent misunderstanding, you think you're a human being in a relative world seeking the experience of oneness. But actually, you are the one expressing itself as the experience of being a human being. I started out by suggesting the current crisis facing humanity reflects a much deeper struggle between the illusioned self and the true self, between misperception and witnessing or direct knowing. Actually, I think it's much closer to the truth not to call this a struggle, but a process of education. But like many things in the world today, the language of the analytical mind has become predominant. For example, the clash of civilizations, which was put forward by Huntington not so very long ago and has become debunked now in modern intellectual circles, but has nevertheless remained as a kind of metaphor for what happens between East and West and so on and so on. The same thing is going on in terms of struggle between the illusioned self and the realized self. Struggle? Maybe, but I think it's much more accurate to describe this as a real process of education, as a process of one being in expression, wholly purposeful, and therefore a gift to be honored and celebrated. It is, Colin Tudge mentioned on Wednesday, a man in Oxford, Dennis Noble, who's written a book called The Music of Life, where he's basically portraying human beings as like instruments. And together we are creating music. Yes, there may be disharmonies, but that's because we actually can't hear the whole. The other ending point that I want to end up with is just to say, to live a life of significance seems to me to entail something very important, which is a deep, humble acceptance of what is happening. That's on one side. And on the other, a very skillful negotiation through apparent irreconcilable conundrums. We can represent it as Mary and Gabriel, if you like. We can represent it as reason and intuition, self and other, known, unknown, It's the way that we resolve these differences that determines our own happiness. These are just some slides to give you a different picture of resolutions and what happens. At each moment, in other words, we can become like Mary and let, as Rumi puts it, let your Jesus be born. And just as Mary's womb was illuminated by the light of the Holy Spirit, the divine light of knowledge may illumine the temple of this life for each of us. And most of this talk, and I'm now going to finish, was written in the Bodleian Library in a special 15th century room, the Duke Humphrey's room, where the ceiling is plastered with the motto of the university. Now, I wasn't allowed to take a photograph in there, or you'd have seen the ceiling. But this is the motto, Dominus Illuminatio Mea, the Lord is my light, which is drawn from the first line of Psalm 27. And to finish, I want to quote a little bit of that psalm, and then kind of as a juxtaposition, to quote a poem by Sadruddin Konevi. So the fourth verse of the psalm is this: One thing have I desired of the Lord, that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire or contemplate in his temple. So as a comment, my comment would be, if the house of the Lord is the heart where the divine is present, then his temple is this world in which we contemplate the manifest divine, because it's here that his beauty is beheld. And then this wonderful poem by Sadruddin Konevi. The way of union is not what we thought. The world of soul is not what we imagined. The fountain of eternal life is closer than you think. The water of life is in this very house. But still, we need to drink it. Thank you very much.